and our sermon text, Acts 12, 1 through 25. Pages 920 and 21 in your pew Bible. About that time, Herod the king laid violent hands on some who belonged to the church. He killed James, the brother of John, with a sword. And when he saw it pleased the Jews, he proceeded to arrest Peter also. This was during the days of unleavened bread, and when he had seized him, he put him in prison, delivering him over to four squads of soldiers to guard him, intending after the Passover to bring him out to the people. So, Peter was kept in prison, but earnest prayer for him was made to God by the church. Now, when Herod was about to bring him out on that very night, Peter was sleeping between two soldiers, bound with two chains, and sentries before the door were guarding the prison. And behold, an angel of the Lord stood next to him, and a light shone in the cell. He struck Peter on the side and woke him, saying, "Get up quickly." The chains fell off of his hands. And the angel said to him, "Dress yourself and put on your sandals." And he did so. And he said to him, "Wrap your cloak around you and follow me." And he went out and followed him. He did not know what was being done by the angel was real, but thought he was seeing a vision. When they had passed the first and the second guard, they came to the iron gate leading into the city. It opened for them of its own accord, and they went out, went along one street, and immediately the angel left him. Peter came to himself. He said, "Now I am sure that the Lord has sent his angel and rescued me from the hand of Herod and from all that the Jewish people were expecting." When he realized this, he went to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose other name was Mark, where many were gathered together and were praying. And when he knocked at the door of the gateway, a servant girl named Rhoda came to answer. Recognizing Peter's voice, in her joy, she did not open the gate, but ran in and reported that Peter was standing at the gate. They said to her, "You are out of your mind." But she kept insisting that it was so. And they kept saying, "It is his angel." But Peter continued knocking, and when they opened, they saw him and were amazed. But motioning to them with his hand to be silent, he described to them how the Lord had brought him out of the prison. And he said, "Tell these things to James and to the brothers." Then he departed and went to another place. Now when day came, there was no little disturbance among the soldiers over what had become of Peter. And after Herod searched for him and did not find him, he examined the sentries and ordered that they should be put to death. Then he went down from Judea to Caesarea and spent time there. Now, Herod was angry with the people of Tyre and Sidon, and they came to him with one accord, and having persuaded Blastus, the king's chamberlain, they asked for peace, because their country depended on the king's country for food. On an appointed day, Herod put on his royal robes, took his seat upon the throne, and delivered an oration to them. And the people were shouting, "The voice of a god and not of a man." Immediately an angel of the Lord struck him down because he did not give God the glory, and he was eaten by worms and breathed his last. But the word of God increased and multiplied. And Barnabas and Saul returned from Jerusalem when they had completed their service, bringing with them John, whose other name was Mark. Who are the great political families of the United States of America? We have come to one of the great political families of the East here in our text today. But how about the United States? The Kennedys come to mind, do they not? Fueled by their ambitious father, Joseph P. Kennedy. And although he never ran for political office himself, his hands were dirty, if you will, with bootlegging, liquor, mafia connections, even murder, perhaps, some say. Well, he always amplified politics in the lives of his children. And as a consequence, John Fitzgerald Kennedy became the youngest president in history. His brother, Robert F. Kennedy became his attorney general, ran for president. You may remember I was just a kid in the days when he was assassinated back in the 60s. And of course, his young son Edward, Ted Kennedy, became one of the longest-serving senators from Massachusetts in history. Did he not? The Bush family also comes to mind. One of the prominent families in America, Prescott Bush, father of George H.W. Bush, served initially as a senator from Connecticut. We are more familiar with his son, George H.W. Bush, who served as director of the CIA, vice president under Ronald Reagan, of course, and then president in his own right from 88 to 92. He, in turn, fathered George W. Bush and Jeb Bush, governor of Florida, Jeb, of course, and George W., president of the United States. And Jeb is even considering running for president in 2016. One of my favorite political families, though, is the Daley family in Chicago. Ever heard of them? If you ever lived in Chicago, you know who they are. Richard J. Daley, of course, the patriarch of the family, dominated Chicago politics during the 60s and the 70s. He gave birth to the cliche, Chicago works. Wink, wink. And that's a triple entendre. It means that Chicago not only is a hard-working town, right? Very hard-working town. People know the meaning of true work and labor there. But Chicago also works. The garbage gets picked up. The snow gets removed. It's a city that runs very smoothly. Or else, Mayor Bolandic lost his job in a snowstorm one year because he didn't get the streets plowed. He was out the next term. But Chicago also works on the sly, under the table. You get payments here and there. And how many governors of Chicago, right, are in jail right now, too, as well? Well, he not only bought his own elections, but that of JFK, too, by 200,000 votes. He waited until all the returns were in, and then he managed to find 200,000 votes to help John F. Kennedy win back in 1960. His son Richard M. Daley served for 20 years as mayor, and his brother Bill has served as Secretary of Commerce under Bill Clinton and then recently as Chief of Staff for Obama. So the Daleys are another prominent political family in America. Now, if we were alive in the days of the apostles in Acts, we would know the political families of the Caesars, Alexander the Great, and most of all, Herod. Herod the Great, the patriarch comparable to Joseph P. Kennedy, Prescott Bush, or Richard J. Daley. Well, Herod the Great had many sons, one of whom figures in our account today, a son of Herod the Great, Herod Agrippa. What does it tell us about the magistrate's relation to God and the gospel? This text speaks very directly to the relationship of the magistrate to God. Let's examine our text and find out, shall we? This narrative unfolding of some of the truths of God who holds the heart of the king in his hand. 3 points I want to make with you. First of all, verses 1-5. Sovereign Sword is the title today. Sovereign Sword. A note to Caesar. And this is, if you will, as we will see, a note to Caesar and any other magistrate that whose eyes may come across the text. Although Herod fancied himself Lord of James' life, it is God who providentially determined James's length of days. It is God who providentially determined his length of days. If Herod had been a true connoisseur of the text, as he claimed to be, the Jewish text, he would have read the account that we read this morning of Nebuchadnezzar and known better, but he didn't, did he? Now, after the exhilarating monumental event of Peter and Cornelius summiting at Caesarea, anything else might seem anticlimactic. A milestone had been reached. A threshold had been crossed. A turning point had been made that could never be undone. The first Gentiles, really, Cornelius and his household, were preached to, saved, manifesting the power of the Holy Spirit, and baptized. Little did those then present realize how weighted towards the Gentiles of the earth the church would then become. So profoundly moved was the entire region that everyone, even the civil magistrates, acknowledged the power of the gospel now extending throughout the earth. Or did they? Or did they? Not Herod. Not Herod. Our text tells us that Herod euphemistically laid hands, violent hands, on some in the church, killed James with a sword, and then arrested Peter. Now, I want you to step back in the narrative a minute and observe with me. Have you observed a pattern that's developing in the rhythm of the book of Acts? Glorious, life-transforming Pentecost brings the Holy Spirit in power and glory into the soul of the church. How exhilarating. And right afterwards, Peter and John are arrested and harassed by the Sanhedrin, persecuted. The church enjoys extraordinary growth, sweet fellowship with one another, with great generosity among the believers. Immediately after the apostles are arrested again, and Ananias and Sapphira bring a spiritual blight to that church's generosity. Now we see the church grows and flourishes even more with the appointment of Stephen to the diaconate, only to see him martyred and the church scattered throughout the region. The pattern is that great milestones and periods of success and growth are followed by times of persecution and setback. That's the rhythm of the book of Acts. This is no less true in the text before us today. Satan never sleeps in his efforts to destroy the people of God. The impulse to oppose is wired into the soul of the enemies of the gospel. The dragon of Revelation is eager to gobble up the children of the woman who gave birth to them in the desert. So keep this in mind. Keep this in mind as you go and minister in your own life. This pattern is reprised even yet in the life of the church. Any seasoned saint will tell you that every mountaintop experience is matched by a corresponding dark valley. Every resounding victory is mysteriously met by a crushing defeat. Every three steps forward you think you've advanced in your walk of discipleship is met by another step backwards. And Luke will affirm this all through Acts. It happens here. Luke's focus here is upon Herod. Okay? We see that name laced throughout all the New Testament, do we not? But Herod who? Herod who? Herod the Great was the original patriarch of Palestine, a cunning half-breed Jew Idumean who flattered himself a Jew, but who was hated and despised by Jews under his rule. We've seen how half-breeds are oftentimes despised more than the purebred enemy. This was the Herod who slaughtered the infants of Bethlehem at Jesus' nativity. Sons Herod Antipas and Herod Philip shared the same wife, Herodias, scandalous, and brought the condemnation of John the Baptist for doing so. This Herod, Agrippa I, was grandson to Herod the Great and was perhaps the greatest local potentate since Herod the Great, having been given a wide swath of land to rule by the Roman Emperor Caligula. Little Boots, the crazy one. Well, the smart and cunning ruler knew that the balance between employing the carrot and the stick with his people, does he not? And this Herod was cunning in that way, that fox. Please them when you can, brutally crush them when you must. A maxim of Machiavelli that every potentate, every tyrant knows instinctively. Here we see Herod pleasing his Jewish constituents when he can. He harasses the church, laying violent hands upon many in it. He slays James with a sword, the brother of John, one of the apostles. When he saw how much this pleased his constituent Jews, who he's pesky. One of the reasons Caligula gives him even more authority and responsibility is because these pesky Jews are so hard to control. But Herod seems to be doing a pretty good job of it. Has a natural gift for these things, if you will. So these Jews more prone to give him grief than gravy. He calculates, Herod does, that he could do more of the same without any consequence while satisfying the bloodlust of the Jews. So he arrests Peter. Herod uses the most extreme arrow in a ruler's quiver, capital punishment, to curry political capital with the Jews. Luke portrays it as cynical and calculated. Huh. For a political ruler to be cynical and calculating, how shocking, huh? Now, God has established the magistrate. We hear this very clearly in Paul's letter to the Romans. For he, that is the magistrate, is God's servant for your good. But if you do wrong, be afraid, for he does not bear the sword in vain. That's a euphemism for he has the power of capital punishment. For he is the servant of God, an avenger who carries out God's wrath on the wrongdoer. But what happens when the magistrate does bear the sword vainly, as he has done here to James and about to do to Peter? What happens when he not only slays the innocent, but the righteous? He then becomes the wicked, the wrongdoer himself, who will be punished. David was a man of blood. That's why God did not want him to construct the temple. He gave times of peace to Solomon, his successor, to do this. David was a man of blood, but he was a slayer of the enemies of God. He was a righteous man of blood, if you will. When he did slay the blood of an innocent man, Uriah the Hittite, wife of Bathsheba, or husband of Bathsheba, who was, yea, even a righteous man. The narrative bears that out, doesn't it, in Samuel? That not only was Uriah innocent, but a righteous man. Invited to go sleep in his own bed when he came home. He said, I can't do that in good conscience. The other men are out in the field. He sleeps outside of his threshold, right? Uriah, a righteous man. David cynically, wickedly slays him. And God judged David then by promising that the sword would never leave his house. God takes very seriously the shedding of innocent blood. Those of you who advocate abortion, keep this in mind. God takes very seriously the shedding of innocent blood and will not hold the nation who does it guiltless. It was a leading cause of Israel's descent into depravity and exile. It was countenanced and practiced by the kings and princes of Israel, such that Isaiah could say their feet run to evil, and they are swift to shed innocent blood. The way of peace they do not know, and there is no justice in their paths. Herod would have fit in with the kings of Judah and Israel. Through the long, sad history of our race, this has been the rule, has it not? Not the exception. How naively, how blandly, how stupidly the American people go on as if all we have is, always has been and always will be and is ours by right and can never disappear. What we see before us in our text today is the rule for humanity throughout its long course and not the exception. We are the exception. Freedom, liberty is the exception. Prosperity is the exception. Slavery, tyranny, the boot heel of tyranny is the rule throughout human history. But Herod would have fit right in with the kings of Judah and Israel. Joseph Stalin is responsible for an estimated 56 million deaths of his own people as he cemented his hold on power and put the Union in Soviet Union, didn't he? Idi Amin, you remember Idi Amin? In the 60s and 70s, some of you are old enough to remember, some of you gray hairs out there. Idi Amin, the brutal dictator of Uganda, after the British left, slew some 500,000 of his own people, even resorting to cannibalism of his enemies. And I ask you, is Assad in Syria really any different than the latter kings of history of Israel or the kings of history? Do you think that if Herod had had chemical weapons, he would have hesitated to use them to acquire and consolidate power? Huh? Men always fall into the same trap when once they get that heady, giddy initial hold on power. I'm the sovereign who bears the sword. My word goes. I can do what I wish. All men must obey me. And it is especially true. It's hard enough for the Christian magistrate, but it's especially true in the case of the godless. If indeed our hope is only in this life, then there's much to fear from the sovereign who would take away that life. The threat of capital punishment is the ultimate lever to wedge the people. It is the ultimate coercion, the prime motivator that tyrants have always employed to cow and herd the people. Can you hear the groans of countless millions slain by the sword of tyrants? Can you hear echoing down the corridors of the future the countless millions yet to be slain by tyrants to come if the Lord tarries? But of course, men like Herod do not account for the real sovereign of history. We've seen this in our texts today, haven't we? Whether it's Pharaoh in Egypt or Nebuchadnezzar in Babylon. He is the living God of the Bible. It is His providence behind the actions of men that sovereignly obtains in the end. As Proverbs says, the king's heart is a stream of water in the hand of the Lord. He turns it wherever He will. The same God who brought King Nebuchadnezzar to Judah to waste Jerusalem and the temple is the same God who moved Cyrus of Persia to release the Jews to rebuild it. The same God who brought the Roman Empire into Palestine with its iron fist also moved Augustus to call for a census, bringing Joseph and Mary to the city of David, Bethlehem. It is the special part of arrogance that rulers do not see these things. We strut around the world stage. Rulers strut around the world stage like Il Duce. You remember who Il Duce was? He was Man of the Year, Time's Man of the Year in 1922. It was Benito Mussolini. Remember, have you seen old films, History Channel, Military Channel? You see pictures of Il Duce with his jaw stuck out and prancing around, just reveling in his power. In his glory when he was going to be another Caesar in Italy. We preen ourselves that we are sovereign. We bear the sword. Oh, be afraid. Be very afraid. Christians know differently, do they not? The Jews knew differently. Psalm 2 is a perfect example. Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed, saying, let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. I appreciate that more and more the older I get, and the more I see the folly around us. He who sits in the heavens laughs. The Lord holds them in derision. Then He will speak to them in His wrath and terrify them in His fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. And this is precisely, in a manner of speaking, precisely what God is about in our text today. The church is growing, it's expanding, it's exploding. It prospers, right, even after this incident. Herod is an early day Il Duce. But little does he know that he's accomplishing God's will. He thinks he's accomplishing his own. God is setting His king, King Jesus, on Zion, establishing His kingdom. The kingdom of God is exploding into the world, and not only is there nothing the kings of the earth can do about it, they actually contribute to its extension, wittingly or unwittingly. And as you peruse Psalm 2, a little bit further, you see that God even counsels you to do this wittingly, right? Heed the Son. Kiss His hand. Kiss the Son. Thus you perish in the way. And I submit to you that this is one of the reasons for the inclusion of this vignette at this juncture. It is a sober warning to future kings who would read this, not get too carried away with their power. In fact, as I peruse the literature preparation for today, several commentators are perplexed at why Luke includes this at all, especially the liberal ones, but they're clueless anyway. Remember what I've told you last week. An author is known as much for what he leaves out as what he includes. So he has included this, left out other things, and included this vignette. And I'm also becoming more and more convinced of the thesis that Acts is in part a defense brief for the Apostle Paul and other Christians who had come before civil magistrates. And if this is so, if this thesis is so, it would be a warning to Caesar and perhaps to Felix too, rulers that day, and maybe rulers today too, if they would bother to read the text, that despite what he might do with the sword in Paul's case, he would be held accountable for it, as accountable as Herod was, and would not and could not stop the extension of the gospel into his realm, even if he thought this would contribute to it. In fact, he would, Caesar, Felix, Herod, would wittingly or unwittingly serve God's sovereign purpose, not his own. Herod, a minion of Caesar, is exhibit A in this regard. And we see this in the adventure of Peter, too. James, slain by the sword sovereignly in God's timing. Peter, would Peter die as well, the same way? Let's look to verses 6 through 19. Sovereign sword. Who wields the sovereign sword? Really, huh? A note to Caesar. Although your minion, Herod, fancied himself lord of Peter's life, it is God who providentially determined his length of days too, extended them. Now, Herod reasoned cunningly. If the death of one apostle makes the Jews happy, then they'll be ecstatic at the death of two. Therefore, he arrests Peter, but does so during the Passover when it was profane to execute capital punishment. Oh, we can't dirty our hands with a man's blood during Passover. Are they so blind? Wasn't it just a year ago or so when they had the man for whom they now preach and speak slain at Passover? But Herod considers himself a righteous Jew. And so in order to safely wait out the Passover and the following week of unleavened bread, Herod has Peter securely locked up in a Caesarean prison. Luke accurately reflects Roman legionnaire practice here too. The night watch was divided into four watches of 3 hours each. Prison guards were divided into quatrains. That is, four soldiers to a quatrain who took one of those three-hour shifts. Generally, a capital prisoner was shackled to one of the guards while the other three stood watch. But here, in order to be extra cautious, two of the guards are shackled to Peter, one at either hand. Ha! Not even God could get to Peter now, right? Ah, these Roman legionnaires, they know their business. He who sits in the heavens laughs. He holds them in derision. The gospel will continue to go forward. We are here treated to a very explicit, overt, and partly humorous account in redemptive history of God's powerful providential hand. Whenever he pleases, he intervenes. Whenever he wills, he guides the actions of men to his own purposes. He will get glory for himself, as he said over Pharaoh. And this is intended to turn the tables of fear upon the ruler into whose hand this book might come too. O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Caesar has his centurions and legionaries. God has his army too. Doesn't he? God has his army too. Instead of human soldiers, God sends one angel to retrieve Peter. And note this about the narrative before us, too. I have learned to love and appreciate Luke's narrative skills here, too, that he trained and prepared a man like Luke to communicate these things to us. With great care and labor and meticulous preparation, Peter is made secure in Herod's prison, right? Or so it seems. In contrast, with great ease and effortless motion, Peter is led out and away from these guards in three fast, secure gates and doors. with brutal, this-worldly presence, Herod subjects Peter to a dark world of stone and iron. In contrast, the angel leads Peter with heavenly light, doesn't he? Gracious words and gestures, and the iron falls away as if no more than paper gossamer. Herod fancies himself a practical, real-world potentate. That's the drift of Machiavelli's The Prince, if you've ever read it. He, Herod, a master in the world of reality. In contrast, the angel comes in ministration from the other world. There's an otherworldly quality about this that even Peter is convinced he's in a dream. Right? See those contrasts in this narrative too? All of this combines, in Luke's marvelous narrative, all of this combines to demonstrate the providential sovereignty of the real potentate. The potentate of time, as we sang this morning. I love that phrase, don't you? That has that alliteration with the T's. The potentate of time. As indeed he is. The living God of the Bible is sovereign. Who will stay his hand? Who will gainsay his promises? This theme is continued when Peter arrives at the home of Mary. I love this little interaction here. Mary, of course, the mother of another character that we'll see woven in and out of Acts. You see how he introduces John Mark here now? John Mark will come in. He will be present in for a while, then he'll recede into the background, but Luke will bring him back too. He's one of these characters that is woven in and out of his narrative. With a bit of humor, we see Rhoda come to the gate to see who is knocking, and behold, it's the very man there in fervent prayer to see released. Aren't they? They're praying for Peter. Suddenly he's there. Well, that should turn that prayer meeting into a hallelujah chorus, shouldn't it? And what a powerful means of grace is prayer, isn't it? It is God's will to release Peter. Therefore, he prompts the heart of his people to pray, to do so fervently, so that in concert with his will, they participate in deliverance, the consequent joy and celebration of God's will. You learn a lesson about this too from prayer. What a powerful and gracious thing it is. In fact, Rhoda is so taken aback that she leaves him standing there. There's a real taste of reality and humanity here, isn't there, in this account? Leaves Peter standing there and runs back into the prayer meeting. There's no accounting, is there, for the rationality in moments like this? Those in the prayer meeting are incredulous. You're out of your mind. Woman, you're out of your mind. Or it's his angel. Now, just a parenthesis here. There was a tradition developed during the intertestamental period that all men had a guardian angel. This is where we get that sentimental, sicky, sweet notion that you see on Christmas cards and stuff, you know, that about angels, that everyone has their guardian angel. Isn't that sweet? It's not very biblical, but it's sweet. It developed during the intertestamental period that all men had a guardian angel who in turn took on the appearance of the person so guarded when they manifest themselves in time and space. Luke does not verify or disconfirm this tradition. He mentions it. This is one of those things where we have indeed not a prescription, but a description of behavior, okay? So don't go running out using this as a proof text for guardian angels. They could hardly believe that the very thing they were praying for had actually happened. But someone was continuing to knock on the gate. There's Peter out there. Hey, guys, I'm out here, all right? What you're praying for? God has answered it, right? Have I come out here so far only to be stranded out on this? I hope no Roman patrols are out on the streets tonight, you know? We have here a vignette of the complete triumph of God's sovereign will. With excruciating difficulty and meticulous preparation, Herod sequestered away the Apostle Peter with great ease and grace. God delivers him. Keep this in mind as you live your own pilgrimage. God is just as much providentially involved in your life as he is in Peter's here as well. Keep that in mind for yourself too. Further, we see the ignorance, the fear, and brutality of Herod extended as he visits the punishment that would have been the lot of the prisoner under the heads of the legionnaires. That's the price they paid. He puts them to death. He investigates. What were these guys sleeping on the job? Maybe they're in collusion with Peter, with those pesky Christians. But he will never know the truth, will he? He's not capable of knowing the truth. Lost, dead heart of Herod. Well, we see indeed he does pay a price himself. That brings us to verses 20 through 25. Sovereign sword. Herod fancied himself sovereign with the sword in these circumstances. A note to Caesar. Although your minion Herod fancied himself lord of his own life, it is God who providentially determined his length of days too. So taken with oneself can the powerful be that they actually believe their own press, so to speak. So godlike can their words and their actions and their pronouncements be that lacking humility, and that's the real trait missing here, isn't it? Godly humility. Lacking godly humility, they can inhabit a world where in their own minds they are indeed a god. We saw it with Nebuchadnezzar, didn't we? Is not this great Babylon which I have built by my mighty power as a royal residence and for the glory of my majesty? God says, you talk like a deluded animal, you will live like one until you realize. And by this time also, the Caesars had degenerated into promulgating to all of Rome that they too were divine, like Caligula, who gave indeed all of this to Herod, being the most egregious example too. We see it throughout history. The Stalins, the Hitlers, the tyrants, yea, even presidents have lapsed into this Messiah complex where they see themselves not only as dynastic but divine. Into this fatal state of mind, Herod falls. And it is fatal, isn't it? Luke tells us a very faithful account of Herod's death that's paralleled in Josephus. Have you picked up his Jewish wars? Have you picked up his Antiquities of the Jews? You'll get a lot of insight into the New Testament background by doing so. Josephus has an account of this death as well. In the normal ebb and flow of politics in that region, Herod threatened to use the old technique of food blackmail to bring the northern regions of Tyre and Sidon to heel. Palestine was the breadbasket of the East. In response to this, Tyre and Sidon used one of the inside men that they have, Herod's chamberlain, Blastus, to gain an audience to petition the government for redress of grievances, if you will, before Herod. And they are properly obsequious and craven, catering to the ego of Herod. Oh, the voice of a god and not a man. Almost as bad as MSNBC. They were the MSNBC of the day, were they not? Beware the flattery of men, especially those of you in power. The voice of men whispering in your ear will be overruled by the voice of God one day. In the early days of the Roman Republic, those were the good days, if you will, of Rome, the Roman Republic, after which our founding fathers modeled, in some respects, our own republic. In the early days of the Roman Republic, triumphant generals would have a victory march in their honor. They'd have the entire city of Rome in the streets with flowers and garlands thrown to them, kissed by the ladies, shouts of praise and honor given to them. That general would lead the parade with his troops, dragging a train of captives following from the war. And the Senate would be out on the parade grounds clapping and shouting. Pretty heady stuff, right? Get carried away with yourself under circumstances like that. But during the days of the Roman Republic, one little humble touch. In the chariot with him, whispering in his ear, would be a lowly, anonymous slave. What do you think he whispered in his ear? Remember that you are a mortal and not a god. Remember that you are a mortal and not a god. With every flower thrown, with every huzzah, remember you are a mortal and not a god. But those days were a long time gone, not only in Rome, but now here in Tyre and Sidon too. Now, Josephus, in his account, adds that Herod wore a silver coat, specially made for the occasion, such that when the sun glinted off of it, you needed shades to look at him. You know, he doesn't add that, but that's how bright it was. What an illusion! What a lie they were telling themselves. And Luke highlights the providential sovereign God when he observes, immediately an angel of the Lord struck him down because he did not give God the glory. And he was eaten by worms and breathed his last. Poor guy. No, I don't think there's too much sympathy. I don't see too many people crying for the death of Herod. You know, it's like, there's something wrong with you if you shed a tear at the end of Scarface. Well, there's something wrong with you if you shed a tear at the death of Herod here as well. He is getting his just due. Josephus corroborates this account by pointing out that Herod was that day stricken with a severe stomach ailment, and he died 3 days later, suffering. And one of the favorite pastimes of scholars is speculating on precisely what the disease was. A lot of ink spilled over this. A cyst produced by a tapeworm, one ventures. Perhaps appendicitis leading to peritonitis, yes, where roundworms follow if left unattended, especially in the days of hygiene in the ancient world. But whatever it is, he died a miserable, painful death with worms. Couldn't have happened to a nicer tyrant. Huh? The upshot, though Herod flattered himself sovereign with the sword, it is the very God who is ineluctably ushering his salvation who is sovereign. If and when this account fell into the hands of other magistrates, they would be warned, hopefully, if they read this account, even Little Boots, Caligula, if he addressed Paul's case when Paul finally got to Rome. You know, notice how dramatically Acts ends with Paul, boom, there in Rome, ready to stand before Caesar with his defense brief under his arm, i.e. the book of Acts. I would submit that in the heat of politics in the United States of America today, too, those of you that follow religiously politics in the United States, remember these things, too. Take a step back. Because indeed, it is God who is sovereignly working all things out according to his will for his purposes. And he will get glory, even as he got glory over Pharaoh, Nebuchadnezzar, and Herod. Is this not in the end a glorious story and a glorious ending? And there will be a glorious ending when he comes to judge the nations too. He will judge not only you individually, but he will judge you for your participation in this nation. He will judge nations as well as individuals. So don't lose sight of that and lose track of that in days to come. But in the meantime, let us come to that place where we find genuine peace, genuine shalom in the midst of conflict, calm in the storm, if you will, as we participate in the meal of peace, the supper of the Lord.